it took me down this rabbit hole of understanding what happens at a cellular level, at a mitochondrial level, when it comes to nutrients and foods that do harm to the body, foods that we need in much better optimal levels for healing. And so from that point, it sparked this love of food as medicine for me. And I went on and studied for a master's in nutrition.
Pauline, hello, and welcome to my show. Thank you so much for being a guest today. I'm really excited to talk to you because I love your approach to nutrition and health. I think you've got a wonderful, wonderful attitude. Welcome.
Thank you, Sonia. It's lovely to be here.
Before we get started, because there's a lot of different topics I'd love to cover, but for my audience and for myself, I always think it's very interesting just to get a little bit of story from my guest and how you fell into sort of the nutrition world.
Well, I used to work many years ago now as a physiotherapist, and so I was working in and ran a very, very busy multidisciplinary clinic. And on the outside, it looked incredibly successful because I was incredibly busy. I had lots of associates and business was booming. I was very good at my job as a physiotherapist. However, underneath that all, my health was struggling and I was exhausted. I had lots of hormonal issues, particularly women's health issues. I was tired all the time, but couldn't sleep well. I was using biscuits between my patients to give me that energy hit just to get me through the long days. And I really noticed the impact that that lifestyle was having on my health, my mental health and my physical health. And it was really from that point that I started looking at food in a more serious way, looking at food as medicine. And I came across the work of Dr. Terry Wall. And she used functional medicine as a means of reversing her MS, the progression of her MS. And it just blew my mind. Already having 2 degrees under my belt at that point, I was an avid scientist. I loved really getting deep into the science. So it took me down this rabbit hole of understanding what happens at a cellular level, at a mitochondrial level, when it comes to nutrients and foods that do harm to the body, foods that we need in much better optimal levels for healing. And so from that point, it sparked this love of food as medicine for me. And I went on and studied for a master's in nutrition, did a bit of a 360, turned my back on physio and really pursued this career in nutrition and women's health after recognizing, gosh, all of those people who were coming to see me, if they'd understood these concepts about inflammatory foods and gut health and mitochondrial dysfunction, all of these things I'd been learning about years ago, the chances are they wouldn't have been there seeing me with all of these inflammatory conditions, these joint pains, frozen shoulder. I kept seeing the same conditions coming up, especially in women, especially in perimenopausal and menopausal women with shoulder issues and hip issues and migraines. And so it ignited this love of understanding at a really deep level how food impacts our current day-to-day health, but also our longevity.
Wow, there is so much there, Pauline, that I'd like to go through. I mean, one of the first things you said was that you could actually sort of heal yourself with the food. Now, traditionally, in society, we are sort of very much pushed towards the pharmaceutical way of, I don't know if healing is the right word, or helping with symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I think if you ask many people, not all people, but they would say, oh yes, you've got to take this drug, this pharmaceutical drug, or my doctor's recommended this, or my doctor's recommended that. But what I understand you're saying is actually what we're putting into our bodies in terms of the food can actually help. Am I right? Is
that absolutely? I mean, diet and lifestyle play an enormous impact. What we choose to eat every single day plays the biggest factor in our current health and longevity. It's a hugely important decision that we make every single day. And so the food we eat can either deplete us, deplete our health, draw down, pull out our magnesium, our zinc, make us feel tired and unwell, or it can add to our health and well-being. And so really, when we start to look at food as this kind of foundation, one of the essentials of living well and feeling good, then we can start making better decisions for our blood sugars, for our energy, for our sleep, for our mental well-being. And yes, we often think of food as just fuel, something to eat to give us energy. But what we eat communicates directly with our cells. It communicates via our gut to our brain, telling our brain whether we're getting what we need or whether we're not getting what we need. It can upset our gut microbiome. It can cause inflammation in the gut, or it can add to our gut microbiome and can create an anti-inflammatory effect on the body. So the foods we choose on a daily basis have a profound impact on our day-to-day health, but also on our longevity and our energy levels and our mental clarity. Such a big, important decision that we make every single day.
I love that you've mentioned the microbiome. Definitely want to go down there. I guess there's a lot of information out there about food and how do we know which food to eat and which food not to eat. I mean, the diet industry is huge. One day we're told this is good for us, another day we're told that's bad for us. I mean, I was brought up in the era where eggs, believe it or not, were vilified. You know, eat eggs and that's going to be bad for you. It's going to elevate your cholesterol level. You know, then you've got this whole myth around, or should I say myth? Maybe some people think it's a myth, around cholesterol and does fat cause cholesterol? Mm-hmm. It is very confusing. What sort of diets do you promote? Maybe diets, maybe not the right word. What sort of foods do you promote? And is there any of these myths that you can sort of debunk?
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. It can be incredibly confusing. There's so much information out there that seems to change on a daily basis. One headline will say eggs are bad for you. The next day it's eat eggs, they're great for you. Meat's bad for you, meat's good for you. It's very difficult from a general public perspective to wade through all of that conflicting information and actually figure out what do I eat. So I always say just strip it back to the bare basics. Our human physiology works in a very similar way, whether we're male, female, whether we're an adult, a child. From a nutritional perspective, we need these very important macronutrients and micronutrients. So we need protein. We must prioritize protein because protein provides the building blocks for all of our tissues in the body, including very important neurotransmitters. So these are the brain hormones like serotonin and dopamine. So we have to make sure we're getting adequate protein into our diet. And that protein could come from eggs. I love eggs. I'm a huge fan of eggs. From high quality meat. Yes, meat gets a bad rap. Processed meat undoubtedly is not good for us, but high quality meat and wild fish are excellent sources of nutrients as well as protein. And then vegetables, you know, keeping it very basic, keeping it to the whole foods, the berries, wild, beautiful, dark colored berries, fermented foods, which are so good for our gut. Again, the vegetables are a great source of fiber. They're a great source of antioxidants. So these are the things that our hunter-gatherer ancestors would have been sourcing, eating, and thriving on. They wouldn't have been sat around a campfire eating a big bowl of pasta, a panini, and a packet of crisps. So, you know, there's a lot of conflicting information that comes, but often we have to question who's giving this nutritional advice and what's their motive. Are they selling a box of cereals to us? Is that why they're telling us it's so important to start the day with these golden flakes and fortified in nutrients versus eggs, which are packed with protein, healthy fats, and a whole range of nutrients? We have to sometimes try and see through what's been told versus what's been sold.
I love that. And that is so true. I love the what's been sold. Believe it or not, I used to do the Special K diet, of two bowls of special K cereal a day. And I thought that was, well, obviously I thought it was going to help me lose weight back when I was obsessed with things. But I thought somehow it was good for me because it was fortified with this vitamin and that vitamin. It's crazy how things have come on. I love the fact that you talk about protein. I'm big, very much into my bodybuilding and have competed back in the day. And so getting protein in is essential for, yes, for me and for building muscles. But I do, again, you know, there's a lot of confusion about how much protein we should eat and the sources of protein. And you touched on the sort of the types of protein. Is there a sort of amount of protein you would recommend?
Well, our protein needs do vary throughout our life. You know, children, they're growing and they're growing rapidly. They do need plenty of protein. And it's difficult with children because they live in a food environment that's very different to me as a child growing up in the 80s, where you sat down, you had your meat and veg. That was it. There was no such thing as snacks between. You went out to play and you came back when it was dinner time. And now children are faced with a bombardment of choices and advertising, and they're targeted from a very young age to become perfect consumers and brand ambassadors from the, you know, the age of three, really, when you've got these characters on yogurt pots and on cereal boxes. And so children are faced with that challenging food environment. And for me, as a mother, I always make sure, as long as my kids are getting protein, so meat, even if that's a nice burger meat patty, like a beef burger, beef is a super source of protein and it's red meat. So for children, it's excellent source of protein. Eggs, some cheese, chicken, fish. My children aren't huge fish eaters, but I do supplement myself and my children with omegas, essential fatty acids, to make sure we're getting those very important fats into their diet and our diet. Then as adults, we'd absolutely need our protein too, but women particularly, from our mid-30s onwards, we start losing something called growth hormone, which is incredibly important for building muscle. And so we can boost our growth hormone by intermittent fasting, but we can also make sure we're getting adequate building blocks for our muscle, and that comes in the shape of protein. So I do supplement protein powders. I'll add collagen peptides, I add bone broth powder. I do eat a lot of eggs. I'll have eggs pretty much every day, omelets, boiled eggs, scrambled eggs, fried eggs, and as well as having at least three or four times a week, I will have a high quality meat source of some kind, whether it's steak or some chicken or fish, but really making sure that you're getting a good portion, like a chicken breast, three eggs, getting adequate protein. People underestimate how much protein they actually need, and they overestimate how many carbs they need in a day. You know, we don't need all of these cereals, breads and pastas. Carbs from vegetable source, like your sweet potato and your celeriac and beetroot, fantastic. But we don't need to load up our plate with pasta and have a tiddly bit of cheese on the side. What we need is adequate protein with some nice veggies, fermented foods and healthy fats. Absolutely key, healthy fats.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think a lot of people are hopefully now seeing this is the way. I went to the supermarket the other day, and I had eggs in my basket, and the checkout assistant was looking at me going, wow, how do you keep your figure? And I said, eggs. I said, getting lots of protein. And she went, oh no, that's gonna raise your cholesterol level. I bless her, I did have a little chat with her. I mean, do you still find people saying that to you? Yes. Or worried?
Yes, absolutely. The narrative out there is still very much fats are vilified. I think it's getting better, but I don't think people recognize our body makes way more cholesterol than we consume. The cholesterol we eat pales in comparison to the cholesterol our body makes. And so having a really healthy liver is very important for keeping our cholesterol levels in check. Having level balanced blood sugars and having reducing the inflammatory fats we're putting into our bodies. So LDL cholesterol happily gets recycled by the liver. However, when it becomes damaged and that LDL cholesterol changes its structure, then it's no longer recognized by the liver and it cannot be recycled by the liver. And what damages that LDL cholesterol is high blood sugars and not having the protective omega-3s in the body. So omega-3s are incredibly important, and particularly again for us ladies, because we are more prone to inflammation earlier than men are because of our rising blood sugars, because of the loss of our muscles. Our muscle mass uses up lots of glucose. And so as we start to lose lean muscle mass, our blood sugars creep up, our inflammatory levels creep up, and we find ourselves gaining weight more readily, becoming achy and sore, and it can upset our mood and our mental well-being. So ensuring we get that right balance of omega-6 and omega-3 is essential for A, protecting our cholesterol from becoming oxidized and damaged, glycated, but also for our overall immune function, mental well-being, and keeping the inflammatory system nice and balanced, so reducing that pro-inflammatory effect.
I mean, I absolutely love good fats. I'm always olives, grass-fed butter. Yes. I go back and my parents are like, how can you eat all of these things and not worry about it? And I go to the doctor and the doctor's like, wow, you've got the highest HDL level, the good cholesterol, yes, that we've ever seen. And it's sometimes it is difficult just to sort of change, yes, that mindset to say it's actually the carbs and the sugar that's doing you, yes, harm, not these good fats.
Yes, and I think when people start to recognize the impact of different foods on your blood sugars, you know, that hearty bowl of oats you're having in the morning, how that spikes your blood sugars, and then you do that big drop and you're tired by 10 a.m. in the morning and you need more food, versus having some eggs with salt and, you know, chowing down on some really delicious protein first thing in the morning and realizing you can go till 1-2 o'clock and you're like, wow, I should be eating now, it's lunchtime. The impact of food on our blood sugar is one of the most important things we can start to recognize for our long-term and our immediate sense of hunger, cravings, mood, well-being, but particularly for our long-term health, because my goodness, does that rising insulin play havoc on our blood pressure, our risk of neurodegenerative conditions, our risk of diabetes, and all of these chronic illnesses that are so rife in society at the moment. We can absolutely empower ourselves with the knowledge and understand that what we eat can take us down that pathway to chronic illness, or it can take us on a completely different journey to energy, vitality, and well-being way into our later life.
So I guess that sort of begs the question, what food should we avoid? Because yes, sugar, you know, in a very simplified form, we think of the white spoon of sprinkly stuff you put in a cup of tea, yeah, but it's not as simple as that, is it?
It's not as simple as that, because sugar, yes, you're right, a lot of people think of sugary foods. You know, I'll talk to people and they'll say, oh, I don't eat any sugar. And I'm like, well, are you talking about the sugar in the white form, or what you're eating on a day-to-day basis and how it's impacting your blood sugars? And then when they realize that bread spikes your blood sugar, and oats and pasta and all of these foods that we don't associate as being high in sugar have this big impact on our blood sugars. And it's not just the impact on our blood sugar, it's the depletion. So a high sugar diet depletes you of magnesium. And magnesium is such a core, very, very important mineral. It has a very wide-reaching effect in the body. It's important for our thyroid function. It's important for activating D3 in the body. It's important for our glucose metabolism. So it helps insulin shunt the blood sugars into the cells. It's important for our energy, so making ATP. It's very important for the muscles to relax so they're not tense and cramping. It's such an important mineral that when we're eating a high sugar diet and we become depleted, we can start to increase anxiety levels, because we struggle with insomnia, muscle cramping, we can start to get constipation, we can start to get thyroid issues, so sluggish metabolism, weight gain, blood sugars creeping up. there are so many of these symptoms that are so synonymous with modern living that we don't always track it back to, well, I'm really depleted in magnesium because of the diet I'm eating and my body's just trying to cope with that diet.
I love that. I haven't just started supplementing with magnesium. I probably started about a year ago. I use, and because there are so many different magnesiums out there, it's quite difficult to know which ones. So I'm using glycinate.
Yes, my choice.
Just could you just talk about the differences in?
Yeah, of course.
Again, that can be very confusing. You know, you want magnesium, but there's so many different types, and you're not quite sure which one.
And it is, you know, magnesium supplements are not all created equally. Magnesium oxide, for example, we absorb very poorly. So you might absorb maybe 10% of a magnesium oxide, but you're actually going to urinate out most of it. And so you might be taking a magnesium and thinking, well, it's not doing anything for me. Why is everyone calling this the miracle supplement? I don't get anything from it. Then you switch over to a magnesium glycinate or a magnesium biglycinate. And all of a sudden you're like, wow, I'm sleeping incredibly. My energy's changed, my mood has changed, because magnesium really helps with our progesterone levels, helps with our serotonin levels. If it's paired with B6, which often you'll see on the packaging, if it's an active form of B6, it'll say P5P. So if you get magnesium with B6, that works beautifully together. Magnesium and B6 are a really nice combo. B6 helps to regulate the intracellular levels of magnesium. So a magnesium biglycinate is very bioavailable, and the glycine molecules are very important for building collagen. They help build glutathione, which is our master antioxidant. They also help to reduce our core body temperature at night, which is very conducive to good sleep. So that particular compound is my favorite. I'm with you. I love magnesium.
Is there a difference between glycinate and biglycinate?
Yes. So biglycinate is just two glycines. So magnesium glycinate is a magnesium and a glycine. Magnesium biglycinate is two glycine molecules. So very similar in terms of bioavailability, but you just have the two glycine molecules with the biglycinate. Then you have magnesium citrate, which again is bioavailable. However, that particular compound draws water into the small intestine. And so you can find that it can cause some loosening of the bowels, particularly as you start to get up to 200, 300 milligrams. Some people find it's the laxative effect is too much. And so women often need more magnesium than they realize, particularly as we age. You know, I'm 44. I need at least 300 milligrams of magnesium a day for me because I'm busy. I know I need to support my progesterone levels as I'm in this perimenopausal period. I know I need to support my stress levels because I'm always on the go. I have children, dog, work. All of the work I'm doing needs to be balanced and bringing my nervous system back into a nice, calm place. So we often need more magnesium than we realize. And if you go too high with the citrate, it can, as I said, cause that laxative effect. Then you have threonate, which is a very bioavailable form. Again, it can help with the brain, increasing magnesium levels within the brain. It's a bit more expensive. And for me, biglycinate does exactly the same job. And so I'm happy with the glycinate versus threonate. They are both great compounds. If you're taking threonate and it's working for you, fantastic. But you often pay a little bit more for that particular compound. And then you get malate, magnesium malate, which tends to target more of the muscles, again, is a very bioavailable form. And then you get something interesting called magnesium nanomagnesium. And this is often suspended in water, and it's tiny, 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 tiny particles of magnesium that doesn't need any form of absorption and would just diffuse through the mouth, through the gut, into the body. Very good for people with chronic digestive issues, with lots of scarring, and they don't absorb well. And the Health Factory do a fantastic range of nano minerals from gold, silver, magnesium, zinc, iron. So those tend to be more on the spectrum of when people just can't access well through their own digestive system.
Talking about the digestive system, and you mentioned before about the microbiome, talk to me a little bit about what the microbiome is and why it is so important.
Yeah, the microbiome is just such a fascinating world that lives within us. It's its own little microclimate of bacteria, fungi, viruses, all living in harmony, in theory, with us. So we house the bacteria, and the bacteria benefit us by producing compounds like a little factory, and their byproducts, their compounds that they produce benefit us. They produce certain vitamins, they produce little compounds that help restore the gut lining, that feed the cells of the bowel. They produce little compounds that cross into the bloodstream and go into our brain and stimulate regenesis of certain parts of our brain. So they are, we have this symbiotic relationship. We look after the microbes look after us. However, when that balance becomes mismatched or imbalanced and bad bacteria takes over and we start to lose some of the beneficial bacteria, rather than having a beautiful relationship with that bacteria, we start having a tug of war, and they start wanting to use up our nutrients, and they start producing pro-inflammatory compounds, which can really negatively impact our health and well-being. And fungal overgrowth can cause all sorts of problems with us, in terms of, you know, fungal nail infections, or we can start to see it in, on the tongue. There's a balance to be had, and what we eat and how we live very much influences the environment within our gut and the balance of our microbiome.
So I heard a lot about leaky gut.
Yeah.
And is this our microbiome sort of telling us that we're not eating the right things and giving us digestive problems?
Yeah, so leaky gut's a very, very important condition that's not that long been medically recognized. For years it was disputed whether it even existed, but really it's undisputable now because of the amount of research that shows exactly what leaky gut is. So leaky gut is when you have this very important barrier between the gut and the bloodstream within the body. And when that barrier becomes compromised, then there's an increase in permeability. In other words, things can start to pass from the gut into the bloodstream. So that barrier is selective. It will allow certain things into the body because it wants them there. But then when it becomes leaky and things like bacteria pass through, bits of food pass through, toxins produced by bad bacteria pass through, then this pokes the immune system, and the immune system's like, this shouldn't be in the bloodstream. And so the immune system's on hyper alert all the time, and you get this chronic inflammatory response that can look like anxiety, low mood, it can look like joint pain, it can look like skin irritations. It can manifest itself in very different ways, but when we start to heal the gut, we can start to notice shifts and change in all sorts of symptoms that we don't associate with gut or gut health, because they're not there right next to the gut. They might be on our face, or there might be a migraine, but as we heal the gut, all of these peripheral symptoms can start to shift.
I find it absolutely fascinating now that I've heard that your mood can actually be governed by your gut.
Yes.
Actually, this is controlling us rather than obviously what we've been taught the other way sort of around.
Yeah.
And actually what we put into us really can affect our mood and mood swings, depressions, anxieties.
It's such an interesting area of science because what we know is the gut and the brain communicate all the time in the most beautiful, sensitive way. We have the vagus nerve that runs from the brain right down to the gut, and it communicates in a really interesting bidirectional way. So you have the vagus nerve is constantly detecting in the gut the acidity levels. Have I had the nutrients I need? Have I as a person consumed enough amino acids, enough protein? And my vagus nerve is telling my brain, yep, got the amino acids we need today. This is great. Am I getting enough healthy fats? Am I getting enough essential fatty acids? So my brain will be looking for, detecting all the time what my body is consuming and what it needs. And if I'm not getting what I need, my brain will tell my body. So I can eat a whole bowl of pasta, and I can eat a packet of crisps and a big fat sausage roll, and then my brain's like, well, I haven't had the essential fatty acids I need, so I'm going to tell you're hungry an hour later, and it's driving my behavior to make sure it gets what it needs. So as soon as we start giving the body those core foundational nutrients that it needs, giving it the protein, prioritizing the protein so we feel satiated, so the brain's like, tick, I've got those amino acids, I'm happy, making sure we're getting our healthy fats, particularly giving the body the essential fatty acids, because it cannot make those itself. And generally we get enough omega-6 from our diet, but often we lack omega-3. And this is a key area that I think, if people recognize the link between omega-3 fatty acids and mood and depression and cravings, it's such a game changer. It is such an important thing to get right. And I know a lot of people are concerned about eating fish. Our oceans are not what they used to be, and there might be pollution and potential contamination. And even accessing fish and seafood for some people is not easy. So if you're eating meat, but you don't eat so much fish, you need to be thinking, well, where am I getting my essential fatty acids, particularly my omega-3s from? And one way is to supplement. You can supplement a wild Alaskan fish oil, or you can supplement, there's a very specific British plant called ahi flower. Now, this is quite a novel way of getting you. I know it's surprising, because we've always, especially as a nutritionist, we've always believed that you have to get your EPA and DHA, these very specific omega-3s, from fish and meat. Some you'll get in eggs, but mainly animal products. But there's now a British plant that's grown sustainably in the UK, and it has a very unique fatty acid profile. And when we consume this plant, this ahi flower, it allows the body to make its own EPA and DHA because of its uniqueness. It has a very high level of something called SDA. So a lot of plants like hemp and linseed have ALA, which we really struggle to convert into these intelligent fats. But ahi flower has high levels of SDA, which means our body can make these intelligent fats from consuming this plant-based source of healthy fats, which when we think about us as humans, and we cannot get enough of our omega-3s from the oceans, there's just not enough there to satisfy the whole population's needs. We have to find novel ways of doing this. And this British sustainably grown plant, I've been researching for the last year and a half and was pretty blown away by the research that's emerging.
That is the first time I've heard of that as well. And the ahi, and where can you find it in supplement form? I mean,
yeah, it's not in a culinary oil yet. I believe it will come as a culinary oil, because it would be great to see ahi flower oil like you see olive oil and avocado oil. At the moment, it comes in supplemental form. So I take it actually in a product called Regenerative Omegas, because I do eat meat and I eat eggs and I eat fish, but I know that to keep my omega-3 levels high, I need to be supplementing every day. And this particular form of essential fatty acids also has a positive impact on our gut health. So I like the idea of taking something that I know has no potential contaminants and also is not depleting from the oceans. I love eating fish, but I started becoming much more aware of taking fish from the ocean to use just the oils. And I wanted to find an alternative, but I didn't believe there was one. And when I found this plant and I saw the compelling research behind it, it just made me think, okay, this is the new way. This is the new technologies we're discovering. This is it's essentially a fish oil from the soil.
I might have to put a link into that if we can, because that's the first time I've heard about
Hold on, let me grab mine because I keep it on my desk. It's this one, Regenerative Omegas.
Regenerative Omegas. Wow. No, I mean, because I absolutely love fish. So the issue I have is exactly what you said. It's quite difficult to find the really good quality. So, you know, I'll go to the supermarket and try and find the wild Alaskan.
Yes.
I love prawns, but then it's knowing which prawns are farmed or not farmed in the right way. And without having all the metals and the toxins that can go along with it. But yes, I do love fish, and but yes, so taking it in another form is always good to know.
Yes, and I'm with you. I love wild Alaskan smoked salmon is one of my favorite easy go-to forms of protein. And I mean, our government's recommended amount of fish a week is one portion, which is nowhere near enough to get our essential fatty acids from. So, you know, it's finding ways that we can work with our planetary health and our human health, because the two are intrinsically linked and we cannot separate them out.
And if somebody is listening to this and maybe thinking, wow, I've got symptoms of maybe leaky gut, or I don't think I've got the best digestive tract, what other foods that we can eat to help us sort of turn our system over? Because as I understand it, it is something that is, curable is the wrong word, but we can change our microbiome, change things quite quickly.
Absolutely. You can change your gut microbiome. When you eat today, that will influence your gut microbiome today. We kind of have a fingerprint of our gut microbiome that's influenced by whether we're born by a cesarean or vaginal birth, whether we grew up in a forest or a city. You know, there's elements of our microbiome that are very much influenced from our upbringing and our medical history. But then the foods we eat on a daily basis, like, are we getting sauerkraut into our diet? Just a really easy win when it comes to influencing your gut microbiome. Kimchi, sauerkraut, all these incredible fermented foods that are packed with pre-digested fiber, i.e. fermented cabbage is a great source of food for the microbes, but then you're also introducing the microbes themselves. The sauerkraut swimming in an acidic juice, which is great for our stomach acidity, and it helps break down food again, making digestion easier. So I would say make sure you're adding in some great ways to optimize your gut health. Fiber, you know, the microbes love fiber, fermented foods, and then removing those things that upset the gut. So gluten is an easy one to remove. If you're reducing your grains and your wheat, then you're inevitably going to have a positive effect on your gut microbiome and the integrity of your gut lining. So I would say just start with a few small things, like, okay, I'm going to cut out bread for the next week or two and see how I feel on that. And Sonia, there are some great bread alternatives. I don't know if you have any yourself. I personally love a keto bagel or a keto bread roll sometimes with some scrambled eggs, but they're made with things like psyllium husk and seed flour or almond flour or coconut flour. They're made with ingredients that don't disrupt our blood sugars. They don't upset the integrity of our gut wall, and they add to our health. They are a little bit more expensive, but my goodness, are they so much better for our gut and our overall health. So there are always empowering alternatives, but I would say start to look at the things that are spiking your blood sugar and that are damaging your gut lining, and add in those easy wins, the low-hanging fruit, the fermented foods, the fiber-rich foods, the brightly colorful foods, your turmeric, spices, artichokes, mushrooms, all the things that the microbes love to feed on. And that in itself is going to have a really positive effect on your gut microbiome.
I'm so glad you said sauerkraut. So I've started again over the past few months to introduce sauerkraut into my diet. I'm just going to ask you, this might sound a bit weird, but so I tend to have it before I maybe have my main sort of food. And it tends to sort of, how can I put it daintily or very ladylike way, sort of gets my tummy grumbling very, very quickly. And before you know it, I can be running to the toilet. Is that normal?
Well, having your fresh fiber first, which is essentially what you're doing, is a really good way of preparing the digestive system. So you can certainly have it with your food, which will probably have less of that laxative effect on your body. But with our gut, it likes to prepare for food. And often we have digestive issues because we tend to eat quickly, we grab and go, and the body produces digestive enzymes, and it starts that preparation as soon as we start seeing food, smelling food, and chewing food. So it may be that you have your sauerkraut, but you have it with your meat and veg, and as opposed to having it first. I think you'll find the more you get used to sauerkraut, you'll be able to have it first. I always have sauerkraut with every meal, but I do tend to mix it with my steak or whatever I'm having on that particular day. But fresh fiber first is a nice rule to keep to in terms of helping to impact blood sugars, helping to positively impact the digestive system. But also another really easy win is take your time when you're eating, look at your food, smell your food, visually get excited, because that gets the digestive juices flowing and that will help break down food really easily.
That's great. I love this. Absolutely. I could talk about this for ages. I do really, there's one topic that I really would love to address, and that's hormones. So I turned 52 a couple of months ago. And as a woman going through, I've sort of just gone through the menopause.
Yes.
And finding things are very different the older you get in life. And, you know, I'm always trying to slow down the aging process. I'm keeping healthy, going to the gym pretty much every day. I go for walks. I've got quite a sort of nutritionally good diet, I think. You know, I'm not going to say I'm super good all the time. I do have a bit of an 80-20 rule. I do like my chocolate. There are a little bits of naughty I do put in there. But I've really come to realize how important hormones are on us. And I was on the pill for about 30 years.
Mm.
And obviously come off it only recently, and actually gone on to HRT. And I'm only reading now what potential damage that could have done to me. Mm. What can you talk around sort of the hormonal issues and what the pill potentially is doing to us?
So hormonally, you're absolutely right. We are governed by our hormones very much. And as women, we so much of our experience of life is governed by hormones. They're very, very powerful compounds within our body. And the loss of hormones, or too much of hormones, we feel it. I don't think there's a woman on this planet who hasn't experienced the effect that hormones can have on our mood or our weight or our irritability or our feelings of emotions. And you're crying and you think, I don't know even why I'm crying, I just feel emotional. And so really working with your hormones and recognizing the peaks and troughs of hormones and how we almost change as a person throughout the month as our hormones are shifting. And then as we go through perimenopause and into menopause, that shift in estrogen, particularly how that plays its part in our brain health, is probably one of the biggest, most important areas. I think women going through the later stages of perimenopause and getting through menopause, it is essential that women understand that metabolic flexibility, i.e. your brain's ability to use glucose for fuel, but also use ketones for fuel, is so important for protecting the brain against neurodegeneration. What this means in a nutshell is, as we lose estrogen, estrogen helps get sugar from the bloodstream into the brain cells. As we lose estrogen, we lose some of that ability, which is why at menopause we can feel very brain fogged and have memory issues and anxiety and all of these things that are going on in the brain. You're like, what is going on with my brain? Now, as the brain calibrates or recalibrates to this shift in estrogen, it happily carries on post that shift in estrogen, and you can feel pretty good again. If there's an underlying insulin resistant state, in other words, if your brain is still struggling to get glucose in because your insulin's no longer working at its best, that's when the brain can really start to lack fuel. That's when you can start to feel the long-term effects. So being able to burn body fat for fuel, as well as mop up glucose as and when, is so important for protecting against the neurodegenerative conditions that women are most vulnerable to, which includes Alzheimer's. So being aware of the power we have over our long-term mental well-being and physical protection of our brain, giving it the essential fatty acids it needs, making sure it has adequate nutrients, vitamin D, zinc, B vitamins, vitamin C, all of these really important sources of nutrients that the brain needs, as well as fresh air and good sleep. Good sleep is fundamental for brain health as well, and exercise, are these really important pillars for our female brain and protecting our female brain from what is incredibly common and becoming increasingly common, Alzheimer's in women and neurodegenerative conditions. Now, in terms of the pill, so the body has to eliminate used hormones, and ensuring that your body eliminates these metabolized hormones happens via the liver, the gut, and the bowels. So keeping your liver in a really optimal state, keeping your gut health optimally, because believe it or not, there are some microbes in the gut that when the liver's metabolized or kind of tagged estrogen ready to be disposed of, the gut can come along and untag it so that the body can reabsorb it. And this is not good news for our body. We do not want that recirculation of used estrogen. So looking after our liver, making sure our liver health is optimal, our gut health is optimal, and our bowel movements are optimal. These three areas of keeping your detox pathways optimal, so important for balancing out estrogen, but really protecting us from the female cancers that can be driven by estrogen dominance.
I mean, is there a way that you can, I don't know what damage I've done, but it was literally 30 years on and off sort of being on the pill. And I didn't know of these, the worst was, oh, there was a few side effects, but I thought I could, you know, I managed to get on one that didn't give me many side effects. But now I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, I might have been doing all these other things in my life to improve my health, but the one thing that I was taking every morning was probably causing me damage. Is there any way that you can reverse that?
Absolutely. You know, our bodies are incredibly intelligent and they're very forgiving. We do a lot of things that upset our bodies, and like diligent friends, they work hard to restore balance and become healthy again. So with long-term use of the pill, often you can be depleted in zinc. It's one of the common depletions, magnesium, and some B vitamin depletion. So it's really looking at, okay, what could I be depleted in? Zinc is a really common one, and zinc affects our gut acidity and our gut health as well. So I would say just look at potentially making sure you're getting enough nutrients in. You may need to just give your body a little bit of support with a high quality supplement of, say, zinc and magnesium. You're already on magnesium. But then just looking at your liver. Liver is a very important area. And again, the liver is so forgiving. Our liver is the workhorse of the body, but it is also the organ that's most willing to regenerate and recover if it's given the right circumstances. So the liver loves a low sugar diet. It loves intermittent fasting. It loves milk thistle. NAC is a supplement I use readily for my liver and supporting my liver's function. And I actually use milk thistle regularly as well, because I love the impact milk thistle can have on our bile production, our general liver health, and those detox pathways. And then cruciferous vegetables, things like broccoli, cauliflower, kale, sprouts. The liver loves sulfur-rich vegetables because it uses it as part of the detoxification stages. So it sounds like your diet is really good. And you mentioned dark chocolate or chocolate. Dark chocolate is a super source of magnesium. I eat chocolate every day, but I always go for the dark, 85 plus. And I see it as, yeah, it's a daily supplement. It's giving me my magnesium, and it's a little square of joy every day as well.
I guess, and absolutely, I love my vegetables. I love my Brussels. Funny enough, people think I'm mad. I love Brussels sprouts. I must be the only person. Brussels sprouts, broccoli, asparagus. I love all, yeah, my greens, all of those sort of things. But I also like the odd glass or two of wine.
Yeah,
I guess that is my downfall. Is there anything that we could be doing to sort of mitigate the risks against the old?
With alcohol, always have it with food. It just has such less of a negative impact on our body when we have alcohol with food. I would also say take an extra NAC and milk thistle, because again, it's going to mitigate the negative impact on the liver. And I would look at just getting some extra probiotics, because alcohol does upset the microbiome. Alcohol kills bacteria. our gut bacteria. We can't differentiate between good and bad when it comes to alcohol. Alcohol's just like, well, your bacteria, I'm going to kill you. So I would just say, you know, if you've had a night where you've had a few drinks, take an NAC or a milk thistle before you drink, even an omega-3 to help with the inflammatory levels. And then the next day, get your fermented foods in to help restore the gut microbiome and give it that extra protection. But always have alcohol with food. That makes a very big difference.
Wow. Well, look, this has been fascinating, Pauline. I know I could chat about this subject for absolutely ages. And I think you've given some amazing, real, really amazing, not just nuggets, but real insights into how we can improve our health and actually take matters into our own hands just by what we're eating. What does the future hold for you? Tell me a little bit more about what you're doing and where you're
going. My second book, Hungry Woman, has just been released. So I'm still in the process of helping people understand the impact of food, particularly on women's health. This book was written geared towards women and helping women understand their hormones, what impacts their hormones, and how they can eat for really optimizing their hormonal health. And so my future lies really in helping women access information and empowering women with the knowledge and information that can really help them change their own health pathway and their own health destiny.
I love that, Hungry Women. So what can you give me a brief synopsis of what's in the book? It sounds
So Hungry Woman, the first half of the book is very much around understanding your hormones. So the relationship between progesterone and estrogen, how that starts out at teenage years, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s and beyond, and what disrupts it. The endocrine disruptors we find in our everyday soaps and shampoos and in the environment, to inflammatory disruptors, to blood sugars, all the different disruptors that we can really help take charge of. Then it looks more at how the pillars of hormonal health are formed, what they are, the detox pathways, how we optimize those detox pathways, blood sugars, sleep and stress. Those really are the pillars of our good hormonal health. And then the second half is full of low carb, hormone balancing recipes, using lots of nutrient dense foods that will support the liver, the gut and blood sugars, and ultimately the hormonal balance.
Wow, that sounds amazing. We're going to put a link to the book. Where can people buy the book? Is it?
They can buy it anywhere. It's on the So & Arrow website, which is, So & Arrow is my company, but it's also on Amazon, Waterstones, Blackwells, WH Smith's, Foyles, any major book shop, or Amazon, I think is a very popular place for people to buy books, but you will find it on most booksellers.
We'll put a link as well in the show notes. And my final question, Pauline, before we end this amazing conversation, is what do you believe are the key takeaways that our audience should take from our conversation today?
I think it's that you have far more control over your health than you might realize. Those daily decisions, those small daily decisions, add up very quickly. Go outside for a walk in the morning. When you choose food, think about, you know, this isn't just fuel, this is adding to my health. And pick some small things: sauerkraut, vegetables, high quality protein. Create a cutoff for eating, say 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, even 8 o'clock, if it's not practical finishing so early, and create a really great bedtime routine so that you get good sleep, you're lowering your stress, you're getting daylight, you're getting outdoors, and you're seeing food not just as fuel, but as medicine and as a healing source for all the cells in your body and your mental well-being.
I love this. Pauline, thank you so much for being a guest on my show. Thank you.